Hello, this is Eddie Duke. Welcome to the weekly podcast at Panther Creek Baptist Church. You know, Jesus Christ is an amazing person. As I look at our culture today, I'm convinced the absolute only hope for this world in which we live is Jesus Christ. And every week, I will introduce you to messages that will communicate this hope that we have in Christ. I'm thankful that you've taken the time to catch us here this week. It means a lot to me that you would tune in, and I would love to hear from you. And now, here is this week's broadcast. Matthew chapter 4, verses 1 through 11. I'm going to start something today that I think may take us the rest of the year. It may take us the rest of the year to cover, because if you got the newsletter through email, you read in there that I was having a conversation not too long ago with a pastor friend of mine. We were at a conference, and we were talking about the state of our culture. We were talking about the things that our culture faces, the challenges that's in our society today, and we were going back and forth. It was kind of a negative conversation, really, it started out. And then he said this. He said something very interesting. He said, "Can you imagine what life would be like if we just followed the life that God prescribed? How much different life would be if we followed the life that God prescribed?" Now, there's no way we can make the world do this, but one life at a time, if we followed the life that God prescribed, it would look a lot different in this world, wouldn't it? So I got to thinking about that. I got more of a narrow focus as I was looking at that, and I thought, you know what? How could that happen? What would we need to do in order to do that? And I came up with this question. Well, we'd have to really ask ourselves is, how would Jesus do it? How would Jesus handle the moral dilemmas that we face? How would he handle the financial decisions that we need to make on a daily basis? How would Jesus do these things? If we really wanted to know the life that God prescribed, we've got to see how Jesus would do it. And I thought, well, there's a verse in Colossians chapter 1, verse 17, that goes like this, and it says, "He is before all things, and in him all things hold together." So, because the bottom line, as we look at that verse, is that it's all about Jesus. And I began to think about in the Bible, what would be the best place that we could go to in order to find the life that God prescribes for us, in order to find what it really means to follow Jesus. And of course, I went to the Gospels and Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And I know that we've talked about this before. Matthew, even though it's the first place in our Bible, it was not the first one written. Mark was the first gospel written. But I kept coming back to Matthew, and I tell you why. I kept coming back to it because here's the thing about Matthew, and I'm sorry, I couldn't find a picture of Matthew in the Bible, so this is when I Googled Matthew, that's the first Matthew that came up. So Matthew McConaughey did not say this, but that's the picture I went with. But here's the thing about Matthew that we need to understand in the Bible. It's this. Matthew focuses more on Jesus' teachings and his acts than any other book. And there's a reason for that, because Matthew, and again, we've talked about this before, was writing to a specific Jewish audience. And so we see a lot of prophecies that Matthew talked about. He wanted to let the Jewish audience know, hey, remember reading this when you were younger in the Old Testament? This is how Jesus fulfilled that. So we see this several times in Matthew. He talks more about Jesus' teaching and about his acts. So if we really want to know what God wants us to do as we face the things that we face in life, I think Matthew is a very good place to start. So I wanted to skip ahead. I know Matthew 1 and 2 is Christmas and how Jesus came about. We may get to that at the end of the year. But I thought I'd skip over that. And let's come to really when Jesus is starting his ministry. And that really begins in Matthew chapter 4, verses 1 through 11. So let's look at it here together, beginning with verse 1. Verse 1 says, "Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. After he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. Then the tempter approached him and said," the tempter meaning the devil, Satan, "and said, 'If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread.' He answered, 'It is written, man must not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God.' Then the devil took him to the holy city, had him stand on the pinnacle of the temple, and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, He will give his angels orders concerning you, and they will support you with their hands, so that you will not strike your foot against a stone.'" Verse 7 says, "Jesus told him, 'It is also written, Do not test the Lord your God.' Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. And he said to him, 'I will give you all these things if you will fall down and worship me.' Then Jesus told him, "Go away, Satan, for it is written, 'Worship the Lord your God and serve only him.'" And verse 11 ends, "Then the devil left him and angels came and began to serve him." If you could just keep your Bibles open to Matthew chapter 4, verses 1 through 11. And we're going to be looking, like I said, every week we're going to be looking in Matthew and talking about how Jesus did it, how he did the things that he did, the things that we face in this life. How did Jesus do these things? And the first thing that we look at this week, I don't know if there's a reason for this or not, but I believe God's ordained it. The first thing we look at this week in Matthew chapter 4 has to do with temptation. How Jesus overcomes temptation. How Jesus overcame temptation is what we're looking at. And I'm going to ask the question, and if I ask myself this question, how do I overcome temptation? Well, not very well a lot of times. You know, I struggle with that. I don't know if anybody can relate or not, but I've got a clip I wanted to show from Despicable Me 3. I know I don't think we have any children left in here, but it's an animated clip, but we're going to show it here this morning. Let's see if anybody can relate to this. Anybody convicted by that this morning? I think I am a little bit. You know, I mean, we see that in temptation a lot. We're tempted to do things that we know is not right. I mean, it's not what it seems, and we see that. But even when we run away, does it ever happen to you? There have been times when I've ran away from temptation, and I've got away from it, only to find that popsicle followed me. It's right there in front of me, and I still fall for it, even though I know that it wasn't the right thing to do. So how do we overcome temptation? How did Jesus overcome temptation? So let's look at it here in Matthew chapter 4, verses 1 through 11. There's three things that we need to keep in mind when it comes to being tempted. The first thing that we need to keep in mind is this: our greatest challenges often come after our greatest successes. Our greatest challenges often come after our greatest successes. The verse 1 says this: "Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil." Now, it's interesting that chapter 4 begins with this word "then," because it indicates there was something going on prior to this taking place. Prior to Jesus being tempted in the wilderness, there was something else going on. Now, archaeologists tell us, a lot of historians tell us, that if you go to Judah today, if you go to Israel today, or that Judean wilderness where it's believed that Jesus was tempted, this is about where it is. Now, as you can see, it's very barren. I can imagine being on there in that location when it's 104 degrees out and the sun's beating down. I mean, there's really not a lot of places where you can get relief. There's not a lot of places where you can get shade. And it's just got to be miserable there. Well, Jesus was in these conditions. But he wasn't there in chapter 3. Because in chapter 3, where was he? Well, in chapter 3, he was in Hawaii. I mean, he really wasn't in Hawaii, but he was in an oasis. It was great. He was there where water was. He was being baptized. And I want to read to you what verse 17 says of Matthew chapter 3, just to see the contrast between where he went to and where he came from. In verse 17, it says this: "And a voice from heaven said, 'This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. So the circumstances here in chapter 3 are great. Man, they're outstanding. He is there pleasing God. He is there around his friends. It's a very highlight moment in his life. Right after that great success that he had, here is where he winds up. And it's a reminder to us that oftentimes our greatest challenges come after our greatest successes. And we need to be mindful of that. If you're sitting here this morning, you haven't been tempted, and you've been saying to yourself, you know what, I haven't been going through any temptation in a while. Guess what? It's probably coming, because our greatest challenges often come after our greatest successes. We see this all through the Bible. We see in the Old Testament, there was a man by the name of Elijah. I love the story of Elijah. Don't you? Elijah met 450 priests of Baal. And these people thought Baal was the one true God. And Elijah said, no, he's not. I follow the one true God. And these 450 priests said, we will prove it to you that we serve the one true God in Baal. So they said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to build an altar. We're going to put wood, dry wood, on that altar. We're going to throw kerosene on that altar. We're going to throw everything that it would take to ignite that altar. All it would take would be a spark to ignite that altar. And we're going to pray to Baal, and he's going to bring down fire, and he's going to light that altar. He's just going to light it up. That's how we'll know that Baal is the one true God. And Elijah said, okay, let's do it. So these guys from Baal, they prayed and they begged and they prayed and they begged all day long. They're waiting for Baal to bring down fire on this altar to show he's the one true God, and nothing. You know what Elijah did? Elijah did what I would do. He started trash talking. Because this is what Elijah said. He said, maybe he's gone to the bathroom. Maybe he can't hear you. He's got his earbuds in. He's listening to his phone. He's listening to music. He can't hear. No, it doesn't really say that. But he probably can't hear you. That's what Elijah was saying. He was just kind of giving him a hard time. And boy, that just made him want to see this even more. So they prayed some more. They begged some more. And nothing. No fire came. Even though the wood was dry, there was kerosene, there was everything that was needed for that thing just to light up just like that. And nothing ever came. And Elijah said, guys, if you don't mind, step aside and let's see how we can do this. And Elijah called, he didn't call for kerosene. He didn't call for gasoline. You know what Elijah called for in order to start that fire? He called for water. Lots of water. As a matter of fact, that altar was about knee deep in water. It was just covered in water. Now, that's not generally what you would ask for if you want to start a fire, but this is what Elijah said. This is how we're going to know that he is the one true God. And he prayed to God, and all of a sudden that altar just went up in flames. That is how we know that he's the one true God. But you know, that was a great success. That was a great time in Elijah's life, where he got to stand amongst those 450 priests, and he got to show them who the one true God is. You know, the very next scene that we see of Elijah, it's not him doing a victory dance upon Mount Carmel. It's not him just saying, hey, who's the one true God? You know where we see him? We see him in a fetal position under a juniper tree, and he is defeated. And he is worried, and he is scared to death. You know why? Because Jezebel has sent word that she is going to take his life, and he is afraid. He is frightened. He believes now that Jezebel is going to take him. And what we see in that story is this. Our greatest challenges often come after our greatest successes. Now, God doesn't want us to walk around and be scared all the time and say, oh man, if nothing's happening now, I wonder when the sky is going to fall. No, he doesn't want us to do that. But here's what God does want us to do. In 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, there is a word that is used to describe what we need to be and how we need to be when we're facing Satan. And that word is this: be sober-minded, be alert. I think in the King James it says be vigilant. Be alert. You know what that means? It doesn't mean that we walk around scared all the time. What's going to happen? When's the hammer going to fall? It doesn't mean that. It means that we're just watching. We're still enjoying life. We're still working. We're still watching. I had an opportunity this past week, Friday, Roger Howard and Larry Morris and Steve Graybill and I, that was it, right, Larry? Okay, I'm not missing anybody. But we went over to somebody's house. We worked on landscaping. And we're there, and we're pulling up weeds, and we're pulling all these things, trying to get all this landscape cleaned up and everything like that. And I'm down on my knees under this bush, and all of a sudden, I just jump out of my skin. I saw something. I really did. I saw it, and I turned to Roger. Roger's by me, and Roger said, "Did you see something?" I said, "Yeah, Roger, you didn't see that? It was a monster. It was like 10 feet tall." No. But I said, "You didn't see that, Roger?" He said, "No, I didn't see a thing." I said, "Oh, man, I'm pretty sure I saw something. I know I'm not just seeing things." But from that moment on, I wasn't scared while I was working in that bush. But from that moment on, you know what I was doing? I was being alert. Okay, if I saw something once, maybe I might see it again. So I'm just going to continue working here and just be alert. Sure enough, not too long after that, there was a rabbit. This rabbit must have been 6 feet tall. Okay, it was a baby rabbit. Just a little bitty baby rabbit. But it comes up this fence just hopping away, you know. And that time, guess what? I didn't jump out of my skin. I barely even flinched. Why? Because I was waiting for something to appear again. And that is exactly how that we need to be. We need to make sure that we understand our greatest challenges often come after our greatest successes. Here's another thing that we need to understand. We need to watch for Satan's strategy. Verse 3 says, "Then the tempter approached him and said," the tempter approached him and said. I want to read to you a verse that Paul wrote from 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 11. He says, "So that we may not be taken advantage of by Satan, for we are not ignorant of his schemes." Why would Paul write, "We are not ignorant of his schemes"? We know his strategy is what Paul was saying. We know what he's going to do. You know why Paul would write that? Because Satan has had the same strategy. You might want to write this down. Remember this, if nothing else. Satan has had the same strategy that he's used since the garden, since Adam and Eve. Satan is not up to any new tricks. He doesn't do anything new. He doesn't know to do anything new. He does the same old thing he's always done, and I tell you why. Because God is the ultimate creator. God is creative. God is new. God is fresh. Satan will always be the opposite of what God is. We've talked about this on Sunday evenings when we talk about the Antichrist. The thing about the Antichrist is he wants to be Jesus. He would love to be Jesus. He does everything to show that he looks like Jesus. But he's the exact opposite of Jesus in every way. And Satan is the exact opposite of God in every way. So he doesn't have any creative bone. Everything that he does is the same as he's always done. So I think we need to understand that. Satan has the same strategy he's always had, and it's threefold, and this is what it starts with. First of all, he started with something selfish. He starts with something selfish. Look with me again at verse 3. Verse 3 says, "Then the tempter approached him and said, 'If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread.'" Now, on the surface, this doesn't really seem too bad, does it? It doesn't really seem to be too awful. I mean, here's Jesus. He's weak. He's vulnerable. He's hungry. He's tired. He's hot. He has physical needs. He needs food. What is wrong with getting a little food? And so Satan comes to Jesus and he says, "Hey, I know you're hungry. I know you need to eat in order to sustain your life. Why don't you just turn these stones to bread?" I think we see why this is a problem in Jesus' response. Because in verse 4 it says, Jesus answered, "It is written, 'Man must not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God.'" The reason why this is an issue is this. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with eating. There's nothing wrong with food. There's nothing wrong with our physical needs. But we have to know and understand that God is always going to supply those. God is always going to do this. Here's what Satan does. Satan takes physical needs. Think about all the physical needs that you have. Satan takes these and tries to make us use our physical needs in the wrong way. Every time he does that, his first strategy is to do something selfish. His second strategy is to do something appealing. Again, this looks okay on the surface. The verse 5 says, "Then the devil took him to the holy city, had him stand on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down. For it is written, he will give his angels orders concerning you and they will support you with their hands so that you will not strike your foot against a stone.'" Verse 7 says, Jesus told him, it is written, do not test the Lord your God. Now on the surface, this appears okay again, because Satan's really saying, hey, if you show your faith, look at all the people that are just going to be wowed by that. Just look at all the people that are going to be attracted by that. If Jesus, you were to throw yourself off this 400-foot building, if you would throw yourself off here and fall to the ground, and at the last minute, angels would save you, look at all the people that would be appealing to that moment. Look at all the people that would be drawn to you because of what you did. There is a huge difference between faith and testing God. A huge difference. I can imagine if I were to go out here tomorrow and say, you know what, in order to get more people here at Panther Creek, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to promote this. I'm going to start out here in front of the church, and I'm going to drive as far south as I can, going 180, 200 miles per hour if I can get my car up that fast. I'm going to go as fast as I can, and I believe God's going to take care of me, because, hey, it'll be to draw people to church. It'll be that people will be appealed to come to Panther Creek Baptist Church. That is not faith. That is a word I'm not going to say here this morning, but it's not very smart. It's just not very smart. Faith is not testing God. Faith is trusting and believing God is going to watch over you and take care of you. And furthermore, let me say this. You know, a lot of us fall for this. We really do. We think we've got to do things or appeal to people in order to please Him. You and I, as believers in Jesus Christ, are not here to please people. We're not here to do things to appeal to people to get them to like us. We are here to appeal to God so that we can please Him. Amen? Amen. That is for sure. And that is what we need to do. Satan is still using this ploy. Maybe I can do something appealing to get people to like me. Maybe I can do something appealing to get people to be pleased with what I do. Here's the third thing that he uses, the third temptation, something greedy. Look with me here at verse 8. Verse 8 says, again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. I don't know about you, but I picture an IMAX theater. I really do. I picture this is what Satan did. He showed Jesus the Roman Empire. He showed Jesus all these empires. He showed Jesus the United States. He showed Jesus Europe. He showed Jesus China. He said, look at all the world that it's going to be. Look at all that the world's going to do. You can have all this if you just bow down and worship me. We still live in that life where we are motivated by greed, are we not? I don't know about you. I know he's innocent. I know the law has found him to be innocent of the charges that were brought against him. But I got to tell you, I still don't believe him. I don't. Here was a person who accused two men of a hate crime against him in a portion of Chicago where there are no red hats. But they accused him of doing this in Chicago. And he wrote a check. He wrote a check to the two guys that he was working with on the set of Empire that were the ones that carried this out. And they even came out and said, yeah, he paid us. But here's what he wanted to do. He wanted to become more famous. He wanted to become a victim of a hate crime so that he could get more money in the show that he was producing. I'm sorry. I don't believe it. But I know his heart. I see his heart. It's with a lot of us. Here is how Satan tempts us. He tempts us with greed. It's never enough. We've got to have more. Here's another family or another couple, Kate McClure, Mark D'Amico, and Johnny Bobbitt. If you remember them, toward the end of last year, Kate McClure was stopped. She wanted to get a cup of coffee, didn't have any money, and so she asked this homeless man who was Johnny Bobbitt. He was really homeless. She asked him this question. She said, hey, do you have any money? Or, you know, he wanted to do something nice. And so he bought her, even though he was homeless, he bought her a cup of coffee. And she thought, what a nice thing to do. So she got on GoFundMe. She got out there and promoted and told everybody, hey, this homeless man bought me a cup of coffee. Let's see what we can do for him. $400,000, over $400,000 they raised on GoFundMe. And then come to find out, all three of them conspired together to cheat money out of $400,000 in money. It's never enough. It's never enough. And that's still how Satan does it today. He tries to tempt us with something greedy. You know, when Paul was writing the letters, the Pauline letters, and he would list certain sins, and he would talk about sin, he would list certain sins, and almost every time in the list of sins that he listed, there was the word greedy. In some translations, it's the word covetousness. But the interesting thing, I want to give you an example of this. Colossians chapter 3, verse 5. Here's where he says it. He says, therefore, put to death whatever belongs to your earthly nature. Put to death these sins: sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desire, and there it is, greed. Every time he lists greed, it's always with a label. And that's the label, which is idolatry. Now, I know there's not a lot of Americans. I know probably nobody in this room would go home today and bow down to an idol or an image. But boy, in our country today, we really bow down to the dollar. We really worship the dollar, and it's greed. And Satan knows that. It's a strategy that he's used for the longest time. We need to watch for his strategies. Finally, we need to remember that Satan is persistent. Verse 11 says, then the devil left him, and angels came and began to serve him. I like how Luke ends this story, because in Luke's version, Luke's account of this story, Luke says in Luke 4:13, after the devil had finished every temptation, he departed him for a time. You know what those words "for a time" mean? That means this was the opportune time that Satan had to tempt Jesus. It didn't work this time, but guess what? He is going to come back at another time. And we need to understand, Satan is persistent, and he will continue to come back at an opportune time. What is the best thing that we can do in order to resist temptation? There's four things I want to leave you with. I think it's on the ball in your bulletin. Four things. Number one, remember, temptation is not a sin. Here's what I see happen with a lot of Christians. A lot of Christians look at temptation as a sin. And so when they're tempted, they say, man, I already sinned, so I might as well go ahead and do it. If I already sinned, I might as well go ahead and do it. If we're tempted to sin, we feel like sometimes that temptation is a sin. Temptation is not a sin. You and I, and God knows this, we can't help what we see a lot of times. We can't help what pops in our mind a lot of times. Temptation is not a sin. But here's the next thing we need to know. Temptation is not irresistible. Temptation is not irresistible. I've had people tell me before, Eddie, I would have loved not to have done that, but I caved into this sin, and the reason why I caved into this sin is because the temptation was too great. I could not stand up to the temptation. That is not true, because 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13 says, there is not a temptation out there that God will not make a way for us to get out. For God will not make a way for us to run. Sometimes we look at temptation as a tug of war, and we feel like we're in a tug of war with Satan, and we're pulling to try to get away from this, and he's pulling to try to get us in. If you think that temptation is a tug of war, here's what you need to do. As you're tugging, drop that rope and run away. That is the best thing to do to get away from temptation. Temptation is not irresistible. Our best defense in temptation is memorizing the Bible. Memorizing the Bible is still the best defense. That's why Psalm 119:11 says this, I have hidden your word in my heart that I may not sin against you. Jesus used three verses out of Deuteronomy. Look at all the verses that we have in the New Testament to fight Satan today. There is not one verse out there in the Bible today that doesn't speak to what you and I face in the temptations in our world. If you're facing something right now and you say, Eddie, could you give me a Bible verse? I'd be more than happy to give you a Bible verse. There's a lot of Bible verses to memorize that speak to the temptations that we face. Memorizing the Bible is our best defense. Number four, waiting on God is always better than settling for Satan. Waiting on God is always better than settling for Satan. Years ago, there was a man by the name of Thomas Brooks. He was a Puritan pastor, lived in about the 1600s. I don't have a picture of him either, but he wrote a book called The Riches of Christ. And there was a picture of him on this book. I don't know if you can see it very well or not, but this is Thomas Brooks, and this is what he said in that book. He said, Satan promises the best, but pays with the worst. He promises honor and pays with disgrace. He promises pleasure and pays with pain. He promises profit and pays with loss. He promises life and pays with death. And I'll close with this. You know, yesterday, Samuel and Sydney and Lisa decided to go to Home Depot. And they asked me if I wanted to go. And I said, no. You know what? I think I'm going to go on a ride, because what's been important to me lately is I want to be fit. I want to be well. You know, I want to lose a few pounds. I want to feel good about you know, being fit. That's important to me right now. And I said, guys, I think I'm going to go for a ride. And so I got dressed, got all ready. They went, and I sat there, and I love ice cream sandwiches. I do. I mean, ice cream sandwiches aren't that bad. They're only 170 calories, but I love ice cream sandwiches. If I sat down and ate, and I could, if I sit down and ate 10 ice cream sandwiches, that'd be 1,700 calories, you know? I think I did that once. But, you know, I could sit on the couch, and I thought to myself, I could just sit on this couch and eat ice cream sandwiches, and I would be perfectly happy. Let me tell you something. We don't battle temptation very well when all of our focus is on Satan and what he's tempting us with. We are going to fail every time. The only way I succeeded yesterday was when I thought to myself, you know what? If I don't get up and ride, and I thought about riding, I'm not going to feel very good about the way I feel and the way I look. And so I need to get up and make that my focus. 2 weeks ago, we talked about Hebrews 12:2. And Hebrews 12:2 says, keeping our focus on Jesus, the source and perfecter of our faith. How do we overcome temptation? When we keep our eyes on the one who's the source and perfecter of our faith.
Hey, this is Eddie Duke, pastor at Panther Creek Baptist Church. I hope this message was a blessing for you today. I want to let you know that we here at Panther Creek are a small church that are looking to make a big impact on our neighbors in our community with the love of Christ. If you're looking for a church home with which to serve and connect with, we would love to have you join us on Sunday mornings at 9:30 for Sunday school and 10:30 for church. We'd also love to have you join us on Sunday evenings at 6:30. But if you can't join us, we hope you'll tune in every week and listen to us. Have a fantastic day.